From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. Children's book illustrator Ted Lewin loves two things, pro wrestling and painting. On today's Fresh Air, Lewin tells us how he worked his way through art school in the 50s and 60s by working as a pro wrestler. Lewin illustrated the children's book The Potato Man and The Great Pumpkin Switch. He's written and illustrated a new memoir about his wrestling career. Also, we talk with writer Andre DeBoost III about the rage of his youth, how he went from fighting in bars to writing short stories and novels as a way to express himself. And the music of Julio De Caro, one of tango's pioneers. Critic Milo Miles tells us about a new reissue. All that coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The United States has decided to add Sudan to its list of countries which sponsor terrorism. The decision comes amid reports that Sudanese government officials may have played a role in the plot to bomb New York landmarks. Dr. Jack Kevorkian pleaded not guilty today in a Detroit courtroom for assisting in a suicide. Kevorkian has acknowledged that he helped a 30-year-old man suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease kill himself earlier this month. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
A new Michigan law enacted this past February makes it a felony to assist someone in committing suicide. But 2 weeks ago, Dr. Kevorkian did just that, admitting in a press conference that he supplied Thomas Hyde with the carbon monoxide and mask the man used to take his own life. Wayne County Prosecutor John O'Hare admitted today that he does support a person's right to end their own life, but he added that Kevorkian cannot be allowed to ignore a law passed by the state legislature.
No one person is above the law. And there can be no exception for Dr. Jack Kevorkian. A prosecutor must enforce the law as written, not as someone wishes it were written.
Still, O'Hare did credit Kevorkian with focusing public attention on an important issue. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Peace talks over the former Yugoslavia bogged down today in Geneva after a clash between Bosnia's Muslim president and his Serb counterpart. The two met a day after Bosnia-Herzegovina's three warring factions agreed in principle that the capital, Sarajevo, would be demilitarized and placed under interim UN administration. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole today warned that the partitioning of Bosnia could invite more ethnic conflicts. He accused President Clinton and the United Nations of allowing Bosnia to be gobbled up. After fierce competition, NASA today announced its selection for both the prime contractor and the NASA Regional Center that will be responsible for America's space station. NPR's Joe Pelka has more.
In February, President Clinton ordered NASA to come up with a redesigned space station that would cost significantly less than the $31 billion station NASA had designed. To save money, an independent panel of experts recommended several changes. In addition to scaling back the station's capabilities, they urged NASA to simplify the space station's management structure. So today, NASA announced that instead of dividing the task of building the station among three aerospace giants, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell, and Boeing, Boeing would become the prime contractor for the project, with Rockwell and McDonnell Douglas in supporting roles. In addition, NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston will oversee the project, consolidating offices that had been scattered at NASA centers throughout the country. I'm Joe Palka in Washington.
The Commerce Department reported today housing starts fell 2.7% in July. Devastating floods along the Mississippi and a housing slump in the West were largely responsible. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 7 points. This is NPR News. A new study in the Journal of American Medical Association finds that most people prefer the treatment they get from doctors in private practice compared to what they get from health maintenance organizations. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
Researchers asked people who had just seen doctors in Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles what they thought of the care they had gotten. 65% of people who had seen a private doctor rated their visit as excellent, compared to only 49% of people in an HMO. The trade association that represents HMOs isn't buying the results. It points out that the survey was done in 1986 and thus may not be relevant now. The HMO Trade Association also says that the researchers failed to consider areas in which HMOs are likely to score better than private doctors, such as the cost to the patient of seeing a doctor. The quality of care offered by HMOs is of more than academic significance. President Clinton's health proposal is likely to encourage people to join HMOs. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said today the Clinton administration plans an aggressive campaign to win congressional passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Bentsen says the White House is setting up a command center to persuade members of Congress of the value of the agreement that will link Mexico, Canada, and the United States in a free trade zone. Police in Haiti today broke up an attempt to display banners and photos of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. If you thought July was a month of extremes on the weather front, you were right. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, it was the wettest July ever for the west-north-central states, which averaged nearly 5 inches of rain during the month, compared to 2 inches on a normal year. On the other hand, it was the driest July on record in the southwest, which received less than half the normal average rainfall for July. And there were temperature extremes as well, the hottest July ever in the southeast and the coolest on record in the northwest. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. When I was a lot younger, I was fascinated by pro wrestlers. My brother and I bought every wrestling magazine that came out, and we would pore over the photo spreads and try to learn everything we could about these larger-than-life men. Men like Haystack Calhoun, who weighed 650 pounds, Killer Kowalski, the original Zebra Kids. I probably read about my guest back then. Ted Lewin was a professional wrestler from the early 50s to the mid-60s. He used the money he earned in the ring to pay for art school. As he writes in his new memoir, I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler, Renoir, Rubens, and Picasso by day, headlocks, hammerlocks, and flying tackles by night. After nearly 15 years, he gave up his wrestling career and set up shop as a freelance illustrator of children's books. And although he left the world of wrestling, his affection for the players has never diminished. Lewin told me that his love for wrestling began when he was a young boy.
My first exposure to it really was my father taking my kid brother and myself to the wrestling matches in Buffalo. We'd go there and watch the matches and practice every single thing we learned and watched, and my kid brother and I became, I think, professional wrestlers by the time we were, or would be professional wrestlers by the time we were about 10 or 11 years old.
Now, what did you like about what you saw there?
I've always wanted to be an artist ever since the day I can remember, and I think there was something about the theater and the art of watching these guys and the wonderful athleticism. I mean, I've always been interested in that, too, and kind of the combination of art and athletics, if you will, I guess, was what really attracted me. The show business, I guess.
Did your father somehow have high hopes for you and your brothers, thinking my sons are going to make it as professional wrestlers?
No, I think it was probably the biggest surprise in his life when we started doing this. My older brother got into it first when he got out of World War II, got in the Marines, and was a bodybuilder, had a wonderful physique, and they kind of recruited him. The promoter in Buffalo, Ed Don George, they wanted a local boy, and my brother was it. My father was well-known in town there as a retail jewelry store he had for 52 years, so the name was well-known, and here's my brother, the bodybuilder and the ex-Marine hero, and it was a perfect combination. And when he started that, my father was kind of... Anxious about it. My mother, too. They thought he's going to get hurt, you know. They couldn't go to the matches. They couldn't watch it. It was just too much for them. And then when Brother Don gave me a call, he was out in Ohio his second or third year in the business, and I was ready to go to art school and needed a summer job. He said, why don't you come out and be my tag partner? And we were, of course, ready, got kid brother and myself, because we'd been doing this since we were 10 years old and waiting for my debut, you know.
Now, you became a professional wrestler in 1952. You were 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your first professional match?
Let's see. I don't remember exactly. There's been thousands of them in the interim. I don't remember exactly, but it was a tag match with my brother because when I first started out, The promoters in Ohio thought, well, the best thing to do is put the kid in with his brother and make sure that he doesn't sort of get lost somewhere in the shuffle. But I can't tell you exactly who it was. I don't remember.
Now, did you have a shtick? Did you and your brothers have a shtick? And most wrestlers either have a kind of fancy costume or they have a kind of persona that mm-hmm. they strut around in the arena.
Or they don't have anything, which makes you kind of a baby face, which is our term sort of for the nice-looking young man who is uh, who's, you know, is going to be not going to do any dirty tricks, and he's going to be the recipient of the dirty tricks, and the villain is the guy that does the dirty tricks. So we all sort of look the part of the clean-cut fellow that wouldn't do anybody any harm, and we wore kind of red, at least my brother and myself at the time, my brother Don, wore, you know, patriotic red, white, and blue baseball jackets, and had no real gimmick, as it's called. Later on, both my brothers, as they stayed in the, they stayed in the business for 25, 30 years. My kid brother's still kind of wandering around the world in it. They took on all kind of personas. My kid brother became Maniac Mark for a while, and my older brother did a few comebacks as the Mask Terror, I think he was called. The old timers sometimes put on masks, and then they're a new timer, you know. But my brother Don never got away with it too well because he had a couple of obvious injuries. He'd torn a bicep muscle once during a match, and that there was no way of hiding that injury. His bicep was kind of slightly deformed, and so he put a hood on and go in the ring as the Golden Masked Terror, and everybody, hey Don, they knew who he was anyway. You know, couldn't hide that.
Now, before we go too much farther, I do want to talk a little bit about the theatrics and how much of wrestling, and we're talking back 50s and mid 60s, mm-hmm. how much of that was really a sport and how much of that was a put on. There's a picture of you and a guy named Bill. Curry, and you have
Bull Curry.
Excuse mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. You have him in a headlock, mm-hmm. and you have this grimace on your face. Mm-hmm. Now, are you squeezing the living daylights out of his neck, or are you just putting on a face for us?
Well, I'm squeezing him, but I don't know that I could hurt him any worse than he'd already been hurt over the years. No, it's kind of a combination of what you see when you see college wrestling or amateur wrestling, and that's the basis for it. And then you add all the ingredients, the things that are the things people pay to see, and that's the flying. Nobody would really pay to see, I think, an amateur wrestling match. They go because they love it and they know what it is. But the paying to see it, getting people excited, that's flying around the ring, and that's body slams and drop kicks and all the aerial maneuvers, the things that that are very, very dangerous to do. Dangerous not only to your opponent but to yourself. And those are the things that need to be perfected so you don't hurt yourself. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. There's no intent to maim or kill each other. That would be counterproductive. But there certainly is a great deal of danger. And I talk about it a lot in the book. As you know, the whole section on the kind of injuries that
sure.
that people have received. I remember once my brother Don was wrestling Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, and it was backdrop. That's where you're flying off the ropes towards your opponent, and he bends down and catches you in kind of in midair and flips you over his back. And they were standing very close to the ring ropes, and my brother Don cleared the top of the ring ropes and landed 15 feet down because the stage was set up on a theater in an old theater house, and he fell to 15 feet to the floor. And, you know, continued the match and everything, but he injured two vertebrae in his, two discs in his back that day, and it was never really right until 15 years later he had a laminectomy, you know, a spine fused operation to alleviate the pain. So, I mean, it was always the possibility of serious injury because of the dangerous maneuvers, which are what people really like to see.
Well, with the kind of grueling schedule that you have described for us, what did you do to actually stay in shape, or was just wrestling just about every day what you did to stay in shape?
Well, that helped, but almost all the guys trained in the gym. So they would get up early in the morning, train in the gym, or run. A lot of them did both, and get on the road. And if they couldn't train, that evening's matches, was the best they could do. But they all trained a lot, and I think we're all in excellent condition too, because a lot of them stayed in the business for longevity is terrific. It's not like baseball or other sports where a 40-year-old is getting already pretty old to be playing. A lot of the wrestlers were in their 50s and even 60s. I can remember when I first started, there were guys that had been wrestling for a very long time, and they seemed like they were ancient then to me, and they were in their late 50s and early 60s and looked incredible, and they were able to move with the best of them. You know, they never lost that. In fact, they somehow got smoother and better, and they got hurt less as they got older because they got smarter, you know.
Did you earn a lot of money as a wrestler?
Well, my brothers did because they were main eventers. They went on the road and they moved from place to place and were always a top, got main events, were top men. But I was going to art school. That was my primary idea. That's why I was wrestling to help pay my way through school. And I wanted to be an illustrator. That was my goal. Their goal was to be the best they could in the wrestling business. So that requires traveling the country and requires being 3 months, 4 months in one place and on to another, so that you're always a fresh face and you can always bring something new to a different area. But I was what they call a local guy. I stayed in one area, and whenever they needed somebody for a preliminary match or to fill in, that was me, and it was I earned plenty of money as far as paying my way through art school and paying my expenses, and it was very helpful when I left school, because starting to freelance as a freelance illustrator is a very, very tough proposition, and most of my friends had to take some kind of a job to support themselves, and I had the wrestling. A few nights a week did it.
Well, did you feel that you were leading a double life? I'm wondering whether wrestlers saw you draw and whether your fellow artists saw you wrestle.
Oh, sure. I always carried a sketchbook in the dressing room and constantly drew them and made a series of paintings which are in the color section in the book. During that time, I wanted to kind of record all the magic of it, and for me it always was kind of a magical thing because of this temporary kind of feeling. I was very much one of the boys, as we say. They accepted me. I could perform with the best of them, and my brothers were both in the business, so I was really one of them. But they also knew that I had this other goal, and a lot of them were college graduates. A lot of them understood my desire to get through school and shoot for something else. And so they knew that was going on, but it didn't interfere with an acceptance, you know.
Well, you have one of my favorite wrestlers from my youth in your book, and that's Haystack Calhoun. I guess and I was probably about 10 years old at the time, mm-hmm. He was so large.
large is right. I remember what.
He was captivating.
We should maybe describe him. He weighed around 600 pounds, and I think about it back then, he was... He was really quite young. He wasn't too much older than I was. I was 17, 18, 19 when I first met him, and I don't think he was only a very few years older. He wore his hair, long black hair, all the way down to his shoulders and a little goatee, and he wore denims, overalls, and walked around barefooted and wore a chain around it, a big, heavy chain around his neck with a horseshoe hanging on it.
Well, I remember reading what he had for breakfast every day. And it was 3 loaves of bread, dozen eggs, two boxes of cereal.
He had to go everywhere by car, all his matches, because there was no way he could fit into an airliner seat. Or into a train seat, for that matter. He was kind of stuck driving everywhere, but a very sweet man. I remember several times being his tag partner. And he kind of stood in the corner while me, being the smaller, more mobile of the two, did all the running around and drop kicks and whatever else, and finally maneuvering our opponent in the right position, and then Haystack would come in and fall on him, and that ended it. But I can remember once being picked up and just really realizing the size of him, because after the match, I remember, to kind of celebrate our victory, he picked me up like I was a rag doll and hugged me, and I remember... All I remember is being smothered in denim, and, you know, he was so huge, like an elephant, you know.
Did the audience ever scare you more than your opponent?
Well, there were times when the audience were pretty scary. You know, the intent of, if you're having a really good match, the idea is to get the crowd riled up, and it should be controlled. You know, you can kind of handle the heat. You can keep people... Or you should be able to keep people during a match within some kind of reason, but something will trigger a crowd sometimes. Maybe it's the certain half a dozen people in the front row or something, but it can spill over, and I've been involved in many riots where it got really out of hand. And, of course, you're in the ring naked and vulnerable, and crowd starts pouring into the ring, and it gets very, very dangerous.
So what do you do?
Well, both wrestlers sort of get—it's what you do in a shark attack, really. You get back-to-back and start flailing out, right? But usually there are other wrestlers watching this from the sidelines, kind of back in the chutes to the dressing room. When they see it start to happen, you can feel it when it's going to happen, they immediately kind of bunch up and push their way through the crowd and get near the edge of the ring. And if the crowd spills over into the ring, they push their way up, and then it becomes kind of a phalanx of wrestlers to and sometimes special police and officials, whoever happens to be there that it can help, and they kind of surround the two main participants. Usually it's the villain that the crowd is very angry at, and they want to get to him. And I remember a riot once in the old St. Nick's Arena, and it was Mr. Israel, who was a wrestling rabbi, wrestling. He really was a rabbi. Yeah, and Raphael Halpern was his name, and he was wrestling Hans Schmidt, who was doing Nazi salutes and all of that. And I must say that crowd really went over. They threw whole rows of chairs from the balcony into the ring, and it was a very, very dangerous place to be. I remember some of the commissioners getting hit with flying chairs and bottles, and it was really terrible. They actually closed St. Nick's down soon after that, and I think that was one of the reasons. It really did get out of hand in that place.
Well, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit more, but first we have to take a very short break. Okay. And my guest today is Ted Lewin, and he is now an artist illustrator of children's books. But back in the 50s and 60s, he was a professional wrestler, and he's written a memoir about those years. The book is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with artist Ted Lewin, and we're talking about his years as a professional wrestler. Did any of your fans ever write you letters?
They used to, yeah, sometimes they used to, and send pictures. They used to take, some of the pictures are in the book, as a matter of fact. They'd take a snapshot, you know, they'd run up and take a quick snapshot or something, and then figure you might like to have it, or they'd run up and ask if they could have a picture with you. And then they'd send it to you and write their name on the back and the date and all of that. I collected some of those. It was kind of fun.
Did you like the fame? I mean, the fact that you could part a crowd?
Yeah, I think that's a sort of, that's addictive. You know, it was very hard to stop. You know, finally the time came when it was very hard to travel and you know, to kind of say, can you go to Pittsburgh? And I said, I can't do that. I'm working on an illustration. I have a deadline. So it got very, very difficult once I really got busy doing what I really, really wanted to do. I just had to finally ease off and not be able to do it anymore. And I really missed it. I had friends that I'd made over 15 years of wrestling. And once I stopped, I never saw them again.
Really?
Yeah, and the only way to see them, I heard about them through my brothers who would tell me this guy's doing that, and that, you know, Bull Curry's retired or so, you know, that kind of thing. But you never really saw them again, and they were like, you traveled and lived day and night with them for years and years. But to answer your question, yeah, the ability to be able to do a specific move and know exactly what reaction that's going to have to a crowd, if you do it right, is there's this kind of wonderful feeling of, I don't know, in a way control, but it's also very creative because the matches just happen. You know, something will come. It's like dancing. You'll try a step and it'll work beautifully and the crowd will love it. You'll just take off on that and expound on it, go more with it. You know, if it doesn't work, you try something else. So in a way, it's very creative. It's like painting. You know, I always saw it kind of as a creative extension, really.
Well, do you still miss wrestling?
I do. You know, maybe I should tell you about what sort of started the book in the first place. That some friends of mine one night said, you know, we know you used to wrestle. And he said, but we've never been to the wrestling matches. Mm-hmm. This is years after I stopped wrestling. And they said there's going to be some wrestling matches right nearby in Brooklyn at American Legion Hall in Greenpoint, in just the next section over from where I live in Brooklyn. They said, would you come as our guest and kind of do the local color and tell us what's happening? And I said, oh, I don't know that I want to do that. You know, I feel funny. And they said, they talked me into it. So we went. It was about six friends and myself and my wife. And we sat at the ringside and I walked into this smoke-filled dump, you know, and I thought, oh gosh, it's the old days. And the nostalgia was starting to kill me, you know. And I said, wait a minute, let me, I want to see if any of the old boys are still around, you know. And And I went in the back and I said, and I remember a friend, Arnold Goldenboy Skoland, used to kind of, as they say, take care of the shows. He would arrange the matches and pay the boys and take the money back to the office, that kind of thing. And we were very, very good friends for 15 years, and I hadn't seen him in 15 years. And so I said, is he around? And they said, who wants to know? And I told him, and the guy looked at me like he was seeing a ghost, you know. Hi. Ran downstairs, and then he come running up, and he dragged me down. It was like old home week. I mean, we were hugging and kissing everybody, you know. And meanwhile, my friends are upstairs wondering, where the heck is he? He's supposed to be doing the color here, you know. And my wife said, oh, he's seeing his old friends and visiting and everything. What happened is Arnold Skoland said to me, you know, one of the wrestlers didn't show up. He said, I need somebody to fill in. He said, would you do that? And I thought, how can I do that? I mean, it's been 15 years. And then I thought, how can I not do that with my my six friends who had never seen it and my wife who couldn't imagine it sitting out there? So I lived so close by, I grabbed one of the friends, swore him to secrecy. He drove me home, and I sort of ransacked the house to find my old bag with my old wrestling gear that I hadn't seen in 15 years. Ran back.
Wait. Did it still fit?
Sure, it still fit. Yeah. Oh, I stay very fit. And it was just the way I packed it away, like a museum piece, you know. And I put it on, and I had to get examined. I had to buy a New York State license because you can't wrestle without one. And I walked into the ring in the semifinal match, and my friends looked up. I'll tell you, the looks on their face, you just cannot believe. My wife couldn't believe it. And I was wrestling a guy named Johnny Ross, who actually broke in two or three years after I did, and was kind of still at it, you know. And during the match, he threw me right out on their laps, and they never quite got over it. But that experience, I called up a friend of mine, Ed Grimm, who's a writer, and I told him on the phone, I told him my whole experience. He said, you ought to write that down. He said, that really is wonderful, and sent it into the Times. So I did that, and they ran a little op-ed piece about it, which prompted an editor at Dodd Mead said, why don't you expand on that? And to make a long story short, 13 years later, I still hadn't found a publisher for the book. They couldn't figure out exactly what the audience would be. And then wonderful editor Dick Jackson at Orchard Books said, you know, it's a young adult book. It's a great story for kids. So it took 13 years, though, to find a home for it. And it all started because of that one-night comeback.
So when you were in the ring, much of the surprise to your friends and your wife, did the moves come back to you?
Like riding a bicycle.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting because we'd all been out having a big party beforehand, eating lots of food, drinking lots of wine. So it's amazing that that I didn't lose that all, as a matter of fact. But the moves you never forget them. I could right now go in the ring and have a half-hour match without having forgotten one thing. It becomes so automatic and so natural, like dancing. You don't really ever learn forget how to dance. You may get a little rusty, but you don't ever really forget it. And I hadn't forgotten a thing.
Well, I want to thank you, Ted Lewin, for joining us and talking with us about your life as a professional wrestler. It's been a real treat.
My pleasure.
Ted Lewin is an artist and illustrator. His memoir is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, if you're a young writer who is also the offspring of a famous writer, it can do a number on your identity. But if you also have the same name, it can really undermine you. We talk with André Debus III about how he's carving his own literary niche. And world music critic Milo Miles explores the classic tango music of Julio De Caro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Geneva, efforts to divide Bosnia into three ethnic states continue to cause a deadlock in peace talks. Bosnian government officials met today with Serbian leaders and failed to decide how to divide eastern Bosnia. While Muslim, Serbian, and Croatian forces have agreed on dividing the country into three ethnic states with a weak central government, they cannot agree on borders. Yesterday, they agreed in principle on allowing Sarajevo to be placed under UN supervision after an agreement is reached. After 16 months of fighting, Serbian factions control about 70% of the nation. However, Bosnia's vice president is indicating some doubts about a UN plan to govern Sarajevo on a temporary basis. Alan Little of the BBC reports.
Dr. Ganic did not dismiss the agreement out of hand. He said everything would depend on implementation. He said he expected to see within days Lord Owen or his representative here in Sarajevo, appointing a governor, deploying the troops necessary to police the withdrawal of heavy weapons, and to proceed with the demilitarization of the city. The whole thing could be achieved very quickly, he said. The urgency which the international community would show in the coming days would be the real test of the agreement. But, he said, unless it is matched by action quickly, it amounts to no more than a trick by the Serb leadership, a paper device with no practical effect, which would allow the Geneva talks to shelve the Sarajevo question, which remains the most contentious of issues in Geneva, and move on to partitioning the rest of the republic while the city drifts towards another winter.
Alan Little reporting for the BBC. Flash flooding continues to batter parts of the Middle West. In southern Minnesota, nearly 1,600 people were forced out of their homes, and residents are also being evacuated from different parts of Iowa. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Flash flooding is considered the most damaging kind. That's because the water moves so quickly. Dozens of people in Ames who have been flooded out twice already this summer are on their way out of their homes again, and floodwater rushed over busy city streets there. Iowa Emergency Management's Jerry Ostendorf.
These are more flash floods where they're going to come up fairly quick and go down fairly quick as well, which is different than the flooding that we've seen here in the previous months where it stays in that location.
Ostendorf says in the eastern part of the state, people are trying to find temporary housing because flash floods there have forced people out of their homes again, too. Heavy rain is in the forecast for the next several days. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 8 points to close at 3,586.98, a new high, on volume of 261 million shares. This is NPR News. Senate Republican leader Robert Dole says that while he generally is in support of President Clinton's efforts to change the nation's health care system, he is opposed to any requirement that business provide coverage for their workers. Speaking today to the National Governors Association meeting in Tulsa, Dole said that employer mandates would damage the nation's economy and hurt small business. According to White House aides, the Clinton health care plan will require business to pay a percentage of payroll taxes in order to finance health care. And to help small business, the changes would be phased in over 5 to 7 years' time. The National Academy of Sciences has issued a new report concluding that fluoride in drinking water is not a health threat, despite charges by critics. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Fluoride is added to the water supply for more than half the U.S. population in order to prevent cavities, but some communities have vigorously opposed fluoridation. Critics usually cite health concerns ranging from cancer and kidney disease to birth defects. The National Academy's new report concludes that fluoride does not increase the risk of those health problems or others when it's added to the water at legally allowable levels. The Academy did recommend that scientists find out how much fluoride comes from other sources, like toothpaste, mouthwash, and vegetables, to see whether people who drink fluoridated water get more fluoride than they need for strong teeth. The Environmental Protection Agency asked the National Academy of Sciences to study fluoride because of the Academy's reputation for impartiality. But one committee member acknowledged that the report won't resolve the fluoride controversy because it is fundamentally about ideology, such as issues of government intrusion, not science. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
In new clashes in the Middle East, there are reports that an Israeli soldier and two Palestinians have been wounded. The incident occurred in the occupied Gaza Strip. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. André Dubuis III wants to be known as André Dubuis III to distinguish him from his famous writer father, André Dubuis. It doesn't seem to matter, though, because he is still confused with his father, even by some of the critics. But that hasn't prevented him from writing. He has a collection of short stories and now a new novel, Bluesman. It's a coming-of-age story set in the 1960s that explores, among other things, the rocky and yet loving relationship between a father and son, Jim and Leo Souther. André Dubuis III has had more physically taxing jobs than writing. He's worked in a prison, tended bar, worked construction, which he still does, and hoped for a time to be a boxer. But somehow writing got under his skin. I asked André to read from the beginning of his new novel, Bluesman.
Haywood, Massachusetts. The Connecticut River sounded different every season. It was a gushing stone roller during the spring runoffs, a narrow and quiet flow in the summer that in the fall receded to a thin, clear wash, leaving banks of leaf-covered mud and sunken tree root until winter when the Berkshire snows came and the ice formed over the rocks and the water gurgled beneath it all as though behind a mask. On its west bank, halfway through the trees up Saunders Hill, Jim Souther picked a guitar most every night. Though he was a white man, he only sang blues songs, songs by men like Big Bill Brunsey, Mississippi John Hurt, Son House, and Champion Jack Dupre. After a supper he would cook for both himself and his 17-year-old son Leo, Jim sat in the parlor on a stool in front of the window overlooking the woods and he'd start to play. He sang all kinds of songs, some fast that Leo could hear in the kitchen while he was cleaning up or doing his homework and he would tap his feet, or else slow ones like Lonesome Road, Up, Sometimes Down, and Motherless Child. Most times they were slow like that, and Leo would sit in the parlor and listen for a while. He liked to watch his father's face. That was easy to do because most times Jim kept his eyes closed while he picked and sang. Leo liked how soft it got around the mouth under his mustache, how tender looking. And Jim was a big man, not tall and lean like Leo, but wide with thick legs, rounded shoulders, and upper arms that always needed more room than his shirt sleeves gave them.
Your father is a writer, André Dubuis.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you use this novel to consciously explore your relationship with him?
Not at all. I purposely try to write unconsciously as possible.
Gotcha.
And actually, there are very few similarities in the relationship between Leo and his father, Jim, in the novel, and the relationship between my father and myself, because my father is a very loud, talkative, gregarious guy, and this man, Jim Souther, is much more, I think, quiet and sort of introspective. And I talk more than Leo. So
okay.
When my old man and I get together, we talk. So actually, maybe I subconsciously turn it upside down, you know.
Well, you are confused with your father. I mean, I'll be honest with you. When we got your book, we thought it was your father.
That's understandable.
And I booked the interview thinking you were your father.
I know.
And I wonder, as someone, of course, is trying to figure out their own literary life and trying to establish their own name for themselves, how you do that when everyone thinks you're somebody else, or a lot of people think you're somebody else.
Well, it's interesting. It's funny. When I published my first story when I was 22 in Playboy, which was quite an amazing thing. I didn't know how amazing it was till 117 rejections later and realized, oh, that never happens. But when I published it, I remember I just put my name, André Dubuis III. They put the third, so I wouldn't be confused with my father. I grew up as André Dubuis. At the time, I still wanted to be an actor. I was drawn to the stage, and so I didn't think it'd be. I thought, well, I'll publish just one story, and then I'll be an actor. But that's not what happened. I kept writing because the writing pulled me. So So once that started to happen, I struggled with changing my name, and for some reason was just not able to. I began to get some real empathy for women who change their name when they get married. It's really tough to be somebody your whole life and all of a sudden be asked to be someone else, you know?
Did you try on certain names?
I tried. Oh, every time somebody would think that I was him or attribute something I had written to him and thereby sort of erase me.
Yeah.
I mean, because it goes deeper than just career. Who cares about that on a certain level? It goes deeper to a more mythological realm of the son never existed. If the three gets erased, then his dad wrote the book. So I'll tell you what, this is how I handle it now.
Go ahead.
I've been doing this about 13 years. I look at this on my best days as a spiritual opportunity, really, to put my money where my mouth is, because I really believe, and I tell this to my students in Boston, that the art is so much more important than the artist. I am so much more interested in the Jode family than I am in John Steinbeck. I'm so grateful he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, but it's the Jode family that makes him memorable, if I think about him at all.
My guest is writer Andre DeBuse III. His novel, his first, is called Bluesmen. We'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Andre DeBuse III is my guest. Let me ask you, your parents divorced when you were about 11, is that right? As you look back, what kind of effect did that have on you? Or even as you remember it?
I'm 33 now, and I think I'm just starting to see that. I think sometimes we need about 20 years before we start to get a real fresh look. I think the effect it had was it did a number on my trust. And I think that's true of a lot of adult children of divorced parents.
Trust of parents?
Trust of love.
Now, you lived with your mother, is that right?
Yeah, myself and my older sister, Suzanne, my younger brother, Jeb, and younger sister, Nicole. I also have two half-sisters from my father's third marriage. Mm-hmm. But the four of us live with my mother in Haverhill, Mass., which is this real sort of, it's a very depressing textile town, mill town. Still depressing to me. I really have a hard time driving through it. My father lived across the river and where he taught at the local school and had an apartment. And so we lived in some very tough neighborhoods, and combined with a mother who was gone till 6 or 7 o'clock at night, it just added, I realized later, much later now, and through my writing I've helped realize this, that I began to believe the world's a very dangerous, lousy place to be.
Well, so when did you take up boxing?
I was about 16, and I had it. I had had it with getting beat up. For me, I took the classic road. I wanted to... I had a thing happen. A guy was hunting my brother down. He had heard that my brother had...
Is your younger brother?
My younger brother. He had heard that my younger brother had deflowered his little sister. And which
was it true?
Probably was true. But they were consenting 13-year-olds in my neighborhood. I say that half in jest, but that's how old we all were in the sexuality of that time. And I remember he beat my brother up in front of me, and it was so traumatic because I was frozen with fear. And he threatened me, and I just was frozen with fear, and he walked away, and I was the big brother who didn't defend the younger brother, and something snapped, man. I was 15 years old, and I just snapped. I went right into the house. I actually looked in the mirror, and with such self-loathing that I said, I don't care if my eyes get gouged out, I get stabbed 16 times, I'm never going to hate myself this much again. And since then, and it's something I still wrestle with, I have been a brawler.
Well, you've been a barroom brawler, and you've been a boxer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the boxing.
Okay,
well,
I mean, what
did that give you? And obviously, well, it's trained controlled aggression.
Yeah, man. I learned something I didn't. I learned a big surprise. I was an athlete. I didn't know that I had a natural athletic ability. It turns out that I was a natural boxer. I went down to a local gym and I started working out, and I became almost a monk. You know, I dieted and I would do things like run 12 miles with 10-pound bars at midnight. If I'd missed a workout, I'd do 3,000 sit-ups, which takes like almost 3.5 hours to do.
You would do 3,000 consecutive?
Continuous sit-ups. This is between the ages of 16 and 20. I was just a complete madman. I went into, and I started to hang around tough athletes, boxers and hockey players and stuff. And we go to bars on Friday night, and of course I didn't drink. I was training. I was training for my first big fight, where I took on a bully, and I actually took on a guy, because I also discovered something in the gym. I had a knockout punch. This all surprised me. It's like this hidden gift. And I remember this one guy, I won't give his name, we're on the radio, but I was afraid of him all through high school. He was a cousin to one of the big biker gangs who had ties to Hell's Angels, who had ties to the mob in Worcester. I was, you didn't mess with him. He's one of these guys everyone hated because not only was he tough and tall and 6 feet and deep voice, but all the women loved him. He had blonde hair and blue eyes and looked like Paul Newman, but I hated him. I was always afraid of him. Well, that night in the bar, he pushed my brother down the stairs. Just as it came
for
around.
For no obvious reason.
Well, it came about that way. And I remember it was the first time I dealt with my adrenaline in a different way. I've learned something about adrenaline. We tend to think it's fear. And see, I would feel all this adrenaline, and I think, well, I'm very afraid. Well, it must be a good reason I'm afraid. I'm very afraid because I'm weak and small, I'm going to get killed.
Well, it's
and
the,
that's
the
rationalization.
Yeah.
Right. So instead, I let my body take over, said, no. I feel this in the gym, and I knocked the crap out of those guys in the ring, so I'm going to do it now. Of course, I wasn't conscious. I was just flowing with it. Anyway, I ended up knocking the guy's teeth out, and then I kept swinging, but the bouncer was in there, and then a huge bar brawl broke out. The six buddies I was with went after the bouncer, and the bar closed down for 6 months. It was a bizarre scene, but it started what turned out to be a string of strange things for me. I would go to bar rooms, and I would look for trouble. Of course, thank God, this is before handguns was in everyone's pocket. This is like 78, 79. But more times than not, I would jump in on husband-wife disputes, which was always stupid.
Well, how typical do you think you were then? I mean, if we read or see about barroom brawls, were they people like you looking to prove something?
Yeah, I don't think it's consciously, though. I think most guys, worked in the factory, worked on the job, and they had no expressive outlet, and they showed up to get anesthetized by beer and shots and, have a release that way. I actually heard a local tough guy once. I was living over a shoe store, and I was just starting to write. This was early 80s. And interestingly enough, as soon as I started to write, a whole bunch of rage just went down, I found an expressive outlet. There was a bar room right underneath where I lived, and a fight broke out in the street. And I knew one of the guys in the fight, and he was pummeling a very big guy, and he really hurt him. And, of course, in these fights, they're more like Scorsese fights. I mean, once a guy's down, you start kicking him in the head until he's almost dead. And the guy finished that, and he started walking up the street shirtless with his buddy and saying, yeah, I really felt like being in a fight. I've been wanting to be in a fight all week. I really needed to just, be in a fight tonight. And I knew that he was consciously looking for a way to express himself. For the first time, it occurred to me up in that room, this guy just needed to express himself.
Do you get a rush now talking about this stuff?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, and it's something I need to write about more in depth.
Let me get back to your father, because I'm watching the clock here.
Sure.
And your father was disabled pretty severely by a car accident some time ago. Let me read just a section of an essay that he wrote, and this is about you. And you say to him, do you want me to carry you down? It's a family get-together, and he's, I guess, up on a
deck.
On a deck somewhere, and you all are out in the grass, and
right.
And you ask him if you can carry him down. And he writes, I do not know. I have not been on the lawn since Cadence was four and Madeline was in her mother's womb. I want to be down there with my family. I do not like being carried. Either I feel more frangible now or I know how frangible we all are. My injury has led me to people with injuries I never considered when I was whole. I'm afraid of falling, of being paralyzed. Being carried frightens me in ways I cannot name. Perhaps the absolute surrender to another human being dramatizes for me the dangers I can no longer ward off or evade. I know Andre will not fall or drop me, so I feel all of this. Caden says, yeah, Dad, please. And I was reading that. I was thinking about as a son, to hear, the utter vulnerability, I guess, of one's own parent. And also, what's it like to carry your dad? You do carry him down, and I'm sure you've carried him other times too. But what does it feel like to carry your father?
Oh, that's a good question, boy. Maybe I can start by answering it in a way to answer it by talking about carrying my son. I've only been a father for almost 5 months, and it's just the amount of love is. I'm just amazed at the degree of love you feel. I mean, I would gladly take a bullet for my son in an instant. And I never understood when parents talk that way, but now I do. And so when I carry my father, I feel, again, gratitude that I'm strong and fit enough to carry him. And I feel, underneath all that is sadness at the loss, but also the sort of dawning acceptance of what is. And
you know, I'm struck, though, with the comparison between holding a four-and-a-half-month-old child, who, of course, fits very neatly into one's arms, as if you're sort of made to carry a small baby, and the idea of what it is to carry a man, as he says, I'm 40 pounds heavier than you are, and just how to sort of gather them up and make sure that you're going to be steady and okay and that you're not going to drop them. He believes that you're not, but just the difficulty of carrying a parent.
Early in his accident, I took care of his bedpan, and he's written about that, so it's nothing private for him to people to know about. That was even more intimate, of course, you know, when you wipe someone else. And I thought at first you have to wade through this homoerotic stuff. I mean,
even with your father,
even with one's father, it's still touching another man's naked butt, you know. And we in this culture, we're very homophobic and got to work through all that crap. And I guess the intimacy is what it's all about. And so when I carry my father, I am having faith that I'm strong enough to do it. When I hold my five-month-old son, I'm having faith that I'm going to be a good dad. And I'll tell you one thing I wrestle with is being a provider. I mean, when you're in the arts and you work carpentry jobs as they come and do part-time teaching, the money's always kind of scarce and fly by night. And yeah, so the heart of that for me is they're both very intimate. And I think they're intimate because I'm trying to face my truth in relation to each of them, the son, the father. And that is, well, the truth is, I'm glad to be his son, and I'm joyous to be his son, and I'm joyous to be my son's father.
Andre Dubus III is a writer. His novel is called Blues Man. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. Linda, what stories will you be covering for us?
We have a young couple in Missouri that we've been following, Marty, and we're checking back in with them. They were flooded out some time ago, and we'll see how they're doing now. Governor Carol Campbell of South Carolina is taking over as chairman of the Governor's Conference. We'll talk to him about what he thinks the governors will be doing on health care. Deirdre Berger reports on right-wing youth groups in Germany. Sylvia Poggioli has a report on what is going on with the peace talks in Geneva on Bosnia. And we're looking for a way to celebrate Mae West's birthday.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Early tango records are not what commentator Milo Miles would ordinarily consider world music. Although internationally popular, tango did not show the effects of modern technology or mass media. But with innovative band leader Julio De Caro, Milo's found music with so much appeal and vitality, he's decided to make an exception.
When a major style of music is beginning, it usually takes all sorts of different forms. Then a small number of master performers come along and knock it into shape. Their interpretations sound so right, so exact and exquisite, that everyone who hears them knows that standards have been set. Musicians who change the style after that will be rebelling against something. One of the men who fixed the foundation of tango was Julio De Caro. He and his Sexteto Tipico were at the height of their powers in Buenos Aires from 1924 to 1934. Caro's instrumentals, tango shows all the tricks and coherence that have served it well for more than 60 years. The tart pizzicato of the solo violin battles with the great swelling sighs of the whole ensemble. The arrangements go through such bold, abrupt changes, one fan has called tango the Church of the Lurch. De Caro's Sexteto Tipico balances dainty chamber recital trills with massive clumps of African-derived beats and a superb example of tango's tough romanticism. Considering how much the accordion-like bandoneon has become synonymous with tango, it's a surprise that Julio De Caro played violin, and the other key member of the sexteto, his brother Francisco, played piano. This might suggest the European strain dominates the music, but the raw vibrancy of these tunes breaks with the old world. Many glib parallels are drawn between tango and jazz. For instance, both arose around the same time. Both supposedly flourished in brothels. Whatever the case, you really can hear the flashy high spirits of New Orleans mirrored in the wit and swagger of Julio De Caro.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shorrock and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the roots of the L.A. uprising through the eyes of children. We talk with Jim Chambers, co-director of the documentary 112th and Central, and with 13-year-old Cleophas Jackson, who worked on the film. I'm Marty Moscowane. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.